Thank you. Thank you for having me. Hi. So I just wanted to take a minute and say thank you again for having me. It's great to be here. I am a UND alum from undergrad, so it's great to be back on campus again. And I'm looking forward to this chat. It's a long one, so we've got an hour, and you've already been here for an hour. So I'm going to encourage you, if you have questions, go ahead and ask them, because it'll be a lot more fun if it's a little more interactive. The other thing I should say going into this is that this will not be necessarily quite as legal as what we've been talking about. My goal here today is to kind of give you a big picture of where the law is sort of going. But I'm going to start with this slide, and if you take nothing else away from today, if you're not watching The Good Place with Chidi there, you should watch The Good Place. That's probably the most important thing I can tell you. But as you heard from Professor McGinnis and as you heard from Tracy, ethical obligations require us as lawyers to keep abreast of changing technologies. And I think in some ways this is particularly hard with what I'm about to talk about, because it's been my experience that my students are sometimes a little allergic to math and feel a little bit intimidated by anything that's even remotely mathematical. Now, that's not true of everybody, of course, but most of us came to the law through maybe a humanities path or some other path that wasn't quite so mathematically inclined. And this stuff I'm going to talk about today requires us to think mathematically. That doesn't mean that we need to be mathematicians. It certainly doesn't need to require us to think about things algebraically or in terms of calculus, but it does require us to think a little bit more mathematically than we might otherwise be inclined to do. This topic and the idea of AI in law has gotten lots and lots and lots of attention recently. So I just have a few recent articles popped up, but there are literally hundreds of articles about this stuff. And in many of these articles, you see, you know, the Terminator on the cover, or you see, you know, robots and lawyers are going to lose their jobs to robots. And there's a lot of dire end of the world sort of talk about AI and law. And I think some of that comes from sort of the mythology of the nasty evil robot, right? This is Age of Ultron, if you're a Marvel fan, or the Terminator. There's a new Terminator movie apparently out. It got rave reviews at whatever festival it was at. But all of these have a shared common theme that robots are bad and are going to kill us all. I think some of that doomsday rhetoric has played out when it comes to thinking about the role of AI and what it will do to various professions. Not all of it is quite so dire. And, you know, the National Law Review wrote, I thought, a very good piece talking about this. I'll just sort of pull out the middle piece there. Does this mean that lawyers will go the way of the dinosaur? Hardly. And I think that's exactly right. AI in law is just another tool. And much of what we do as lawyers isn't going to be any different. I always think of our job as lawyers is a couple of things, right? Our job as lawyers is, first of all, something a bit like garbage folks. We help our clients sort out all of their nasty business and figure out what bin to put it in. Part of what we do as lawyers is, of course, craft persuasive arguments to achieve our clients' goals and clients' ends. And part of what we do is try to represent society as a whole and take seriously our ethical obligations to make society a better place. All of those things remain true. This is just another set of technologies that can help us do those basic things. So I think of AI as not replacing humans, that it is, in fact, just another tool that works in conjunction with human knowledge and human understanding. My goal today is to sort of do three big picture things. First, I just kind of want to set up the rules of the game. It's my experience, and I may be wrong, and if I'm wrong, folks can chime in if you know more than I do about this, which you might, but it's my experience that folks struggle with this topic because they don't really understand what AI is. So I'm going to start off by kind of doing a big picture conversation about what AI is and how it works, because I think that's important, especially when we get to some of the things that AI is doing in the practice of law. It really matters that you're able to interface with your external experts, and probably for most of these things you're using external experts, and understand what value they're providing and how they're providing that value. So I'm going to start with that. Then I'm going to talk about some of the current uses, and some of this will be interspersed as we go along, some of the current uses of AI, and then at the end sort of point towards the future and what the future might well look like, some of the things we already see on the horizon, and then maybe some big picture visions of where we might go. I think it's important to remember that technology always has some hype. So this is the very famous Gartner hype cycle. It talks about, you know, the sort of innovation cycle. You've got this trigger and there's this moment where there's all kinds of inflated expectations, and then there's thorough disillusionment with all technologies, and then finally we sort of get to some middle ground. In many ways, I think that we are right here. Mind the gap. I go to London and teach a summer program in London. For those of you who are law students, you can talk to me about that if you're interested. Fantastic, fun stuff. But mind the gap. Make sure you don't trip on your way down. I think we're in many ways at that moment with AI and technology. I'm not sure that we've quite gotten to the plateau of productivity yet. There's a lot going on. It's exciting, but it's also nerve-wracking. The basics of AI, I think, are the place to sort of start. And in thinking about the basics of AI, it's sort of important, I think, to recognize there are two big pathways to AI and anything. There's sort of a older pathway, which is my little old robot, and then my new fancy robot up there. And these two pathways are not mutually exclusive, but they do represent two different approaches to thinking about AI. But at the very sort of beginning, what do we mean by AI? I mean, this is a rough and ready definition. There are much more technical ones out there. But basically, we're using computers or computations to solve problems or automate decision-making. And this is the sort of decision-making or problem-solving that humans regularly do, and we attach intelligence to that sort of process. That's all AI is doing, right, at a basic, simple level. And there are kind of two big visions of AI. There's sort of a strong vision of AI. In an idealized world, if AI was doing everything that it could possibly do, it might be described as computers solving problems or working out solutions to things better than humans could. And you might even go further and think about strong AI as involving some sort of abstract reasoning or abductive thinking. You know, abductive thinking different than deduction or induction, because those are both logical processes. Abductive thinking is where we sort of make inferences that are not necessarily logically true. Humans do that all the time. In fact, most of our decision-making is abductive. We're making guesses, rough and ready sort of guesses. And law is a lot of abductive reasoning, where we're not really making truly logically coherent arguments. We're using logic as a rough framework to make some guesses, right? And persuasive guesses. We have none of that, really. There's no AI that exists in the world that's truly doing what strong AI is, right? This is the sort of thing like Terminators ruling the world, like intelligent machines. We don't have that under any of the best circumstances. Weak AI, which is really what we have, amounts to computers solving problems by spotting patterns in data. And really, that's all AI is doing. Even the most sophisticated AI on the planet is really just pattern recognition. There are two kind of ways to get to that pattern recognition. And sort of, well, this list sort of lays out sort of four different ways of thinking about AI. But I'm going to talk about AI as machine learning as sort of the frontier of where we're going. And I'll explain what I mean by that later. But you can see AI is sort of all one big, it's not exactly a Venn diagram. It's sort of smaller concentric circles with algorithms kind of at the core. So all AI is about some kind of algorithm. All an algorithm is just a basic process that you're following, right? It's just a stepwise process. A recipe in a cookbook is a kind of algorithm, just following a stepwise process. Now, usually when we think of algorithms, we think of more decision trees than a cookbook. A cookbook's sort of a one-way, a simple, unitary algorithm, whereas we normally think of there being some sort of decision-making process where you follow different paths, but algorithms don't have to be particularly complicated. There are two big visions of AI then. One is logic and rule-based AI, which is just, I say algorithmic, but I put that in quotation marks. All AI is kind of algorithmic. But logic and rule-based systems are where you have experts who design a pathway through something, right? So you can imagine doctors do this a lot when they have differential diagnoses, right? They have a process where they ask questions, and depending on what the answer is, they ask a different question, right? And they sort of go through this differential process that's been designed by some expert in the world, and all of the right questions are being asked. Boolean search terms are another kind of basic algorithmic process that we're all familiar with. I mean, these days, of course, Westlaw lets you do things without even Boolean search terms, but still I find it useful sometimes to limit my searches using Boolean terms. And on the other end, we've got big data. And big data-driven pattern recognition. And this is really what machine learning is all about. And by big data, this references back to the notion that Tracy was talking about, that you've got to have gigantic storage. One of the reasons why we've seen what this term machine learning, which is only really, I mean, it's in its infancy, 10 years old kind of at best. Well, why do we see it all of a sudden in the world? Because computing power has exponentially increased and the costs of storage have decreased dramatically. So we can process just tremendous amounts of data. And that allows us to do something very different in the world. Let me talk first about the rule-based sort of thing and what we see in law, because we see a lot of it. Actually, there's already a whole lot of AI in the sense of rule-based AI. We've got tax programs, right? If you go do your taxes on one of the tax sort of websites, that's a kind of rule-based AI. It's going to ask you a bunch of questions, and then it's going to fill out your tax forms for you, so you don't have to do it. It'll ask you questions usually in natural language. They've gotten pretty good these days, right? There's kind of a little chat bot on many of them, so even if you've got questions, it'll ask you the right questions and help you fill it out. In Minnesota, we've got a self-help process for people who want to go through divorces and don't have complex sort of divorce problems. It's a set of questions, a very simple sort of questionnaire. Depending on what answers you provide, it takes you to other questions, right? And it's a simple process that's run through the state, because we might have, and we have seen with other vendors, some ethical concerns that this is a practice of law without a lawyer, right? And that's a area that's still nascent as well. Exactly what can these sort of programs do and what can't they do? But then we also see all kinds of just basic decision tree software. Lawyers making decision trees or lawyers buying sets of things that give them sort of processes to follow. That, you know, this one that I have here is the Class Action Fairness Act, walking you through whether you've got problems with the Class Action Fairness Act. And then we've got sort of the cutting edge of all of this, sort of more bespoke kind of chat bots. There are a number of states that are working on this because access to justice is maybe the most important question for lawyers these days, right? We've sort of priced ourselves out of the marketplace, and there are so many people who just can't afford our services anymore. There are so many people who need legal services. So states are wrestling with this question, and one way to do it is to create sort of smart algorithms that allow people to have access self-help, much like I was saying with the divorce process in Minnesota. But you could do that with a lot of other areas of law. And as these sort of chatbots get created, a lot of it is being done by hiring experts, law professors, or expert attorneys in the field to sort of create these pathways that help you out. All of these things give us a lot of potential, right? The existing world of rule-based AI has the potential to create client intake forms. In fact, we see some law firms. I was just working with a law firm last week that was working on a client intake form and wanted some help on an algorithm that they were doing. The idea there is that you could tailor and streamline the intake process so that you kind of get all of the basic questioning out of the way and can focus your attorney time, which helps the client because it saves money for the client, and it helps the attorney because you kind of get all of the other stuff out of the way and you can sort of tailor your questions right out of the get-go. You could have client updates and communications, much like, and this is something that I've not seen anybody do yet, but I've heard people talking about it, like client portals that are like what you have for healthcare portals, right? You can go on your healthcare portal and get a lot of information, but these would be more interactive than all of that. You know, clients don't know, you give them raw information about, you know, what the court process is. They don't know what that means. So this would be more of an interactive chatbot sort of environment where they could ask questions effectively and get some answers. And depending on what questions they got and what answers they wanted, sort of more sophisticated information, more robust self-help options, which is sort of what I was talking about earlier. And then a really interesting frontier in all of this is online dispute resolution. So I have a colleague, Dave Larson, who is an expert in ODR, online dispute resolution. He's helping New York right now finalize all of their, it's a pilot program, but they eventually want to have all of their conciliation court cases be resolved through an online arbitration process. So it would be sort of not arbitration as you, I teach it. It's not private arbitration. It's state-governed arbitration, but it would take away conciliation court, move it all online. Alaska is much more aggressive about this. Alaska has already announced that they want to take all cases under 50,000 that are civil cases and shunt them into an online dispute resolution form. They want to do away with those in court altogether. These implicate just basic technology concerns, right? In some cases, you would still just have a judge and you would just be doing a lot of things online, sharing information and stuff. But in some cases, like what my colleague Dave Larson is doing, they implicate online dispute resolution bots. So you actually have bots doing a lot of the work that we would normally think of a decision maker doing by having the parties submit certain information along the way. The problem with all of those rule-based, those rule-driven sorts of approaches is that it all requires expertise. So that's problematic. I'm a good law and economics guy. It's expensive, right? Expertise is expensive and time-consuming. But there's a more fundamental problem, I think, and that is that experts just turn out not to be that good. Experts aren't necessarily real good. Humans, it turns out, are real rubbish at recognizing patterns. We think we're good at it, and in some cases, we're very, very good at it. There are things humans are excellent at recognizing, right? Certain skills that humans have. For instance, humans are really good at judging where a football is when you're going to catch it, right? You throw a football, humans can judge that real well. We still can't build robots that come even close to being able to approximate the skill that humans have for that. But humans are real, real bad at recognizing basic patterns in data. So this is an experiment from 2004. It's in the Columbia Law Review if you want to go check it out. And I just note, this is 2004. So as Tammy was saying, iPhones 2007, right? This is at the beginning of the sort of modern version of the technology revolution. So this experiment is old. This experiment pitted a set of world-class SCOTUS experts. These were people who practiced before the Supreme Court regularly. These are law professors who specialize, like Lawrence Tribe, like Erwin Chemerinsky. I mean, I'm not talking just some experts. I'm talking like the world-leading experts on the Supreme Court. These people were then subdivided. So they were competing against this very rudimentary algorithm, but they were even more subdivided than that. It wasn't just that they were Supreme Court experts. You would take Supreme Court experts who had expertise in particular areas, and they were just guessing about the subset of the 68 cases from that year's term in their areas. So they weren't doing the whole thing. These were the world-leading experts. They got the case level guesses about what the Supreme Court was going to do 59% of the time, just barely better than a flip of a coin is what the experts did. This rudimentary algorithm, and by rudimentary, I truly mean it, it had as its crass variables things like, was the lower court decision, the district court decision, was it overturned or was it upheld at the appellate court level? What circuit did the case come from? Was the district court judge appointed by a Republican or a Democrat? Like super crass variables, like nothing that you would imagine was real detailed. It got it right 75% of the time. Why? Well, because again, it turns out humans just aren't particularly good. If you're interested in thinking about why, and you're interested in thinking about sort of the cognitive biases that make humans problematic decision makers when it comes to data, I highly recommend Nate Silver's book. If you don't know Nate Silver, he runs a blog. He ran a blog. It's on presidential elections is where he got famous, but he also did a lot of sports betting stuff. This book is super accessible, The Signal and the Noise, and the basic upshot of his argument is humans wind up often getting lost in the noise. They focus on the wrong sorts of details rather than details that actually matter to the decision-making process. And that kind of gets us to the idea of machine learning. The idea of machine learning is that we can wind up creating better decision-making environments by abstracting away what humans think is important and just identifying patterns that achieve an outcome. That's all that self-driving cars do. The idea of machine learning is kind of simple. in a sense, what machine learning does is it takes a big enough data set. You feed a computer a bunch and bunch and bunch and bunch and bunch of data. And then you tell the computer, look, this thing is an apple. This thing is a whatever, horse, sheep, dog, whatever you want. You tell the computer what the right thing is, and then you feed it bunches of data, and it spits back out its guesses about whether a thing's an apple or a dog. It's going to get some stuff wrong. It gets stuff wrong a lot, and then you tell it, you correct it, and you tell it, no, that's an apple, that's a dog. Is it really learning to see apples and dogs? No, but what it's doing is it's learning to pick out salient characteristics that we might not even see, things that humans might not be noticing. But it's learning to see salient characteristics and link those up across a data set. Now, this requires, to be effective, huge, huge amounts of data because it's going to get it wrong a lot. But the steps are basically you choose a data set, then you massage it and clean it up, right? So some human goes through it and kind of cleans up the data set, gets rid of outliers or whatever. Then you split it into a training or a test set. So humans will collate some small set of things and sort of segregate it and say, these are apples, these are dogs, these are horses, right? Separate them out. And then you apply a basic algorithm. And the basic algorithm actually in most machine learning is a sort of iterative algorithm that simply is a sort of, if you got it right, you know, the computer will look at the right thing and start identifying characteristics in the right thing. Now, humans have programmed the basic algorithm, but the computer actually starts to extract other elements from whatever the thing is, other elements that might be relevant, and it creates a statistical probability map effectively. And it says, look, in all the things that I got right, these five characteristics exist. Now, again, those characteristics might not be things humans ever notice or think of. They might not be the same things we see when we see apples and horses, but it sees if these five things are there, the probability that I got it right, it goes up to 85%, right? You add a sixth thing, it goes up to 95%, boom, that's how it's sort of figuring out or learning what works. What are the things that are already doing this? Well, lots of things in the world already do this and do it quite well. This is Netflix. All of the Netflix algorithms that teach you how to do things. I actually think the better algorithm for me is always Spotify. I am so friggin' unbelievably amazed at how good it is. I just listen to my Discover Weekly, and at this point, it gets it right like all the time. Every song that's on there, I like almost every song. You know, it's sort of learned what it is. It's terrifying. It's truly terrifying. The cautionary tale I always tell, not cautionary, I mean, it's creepy, but also kind of awesome, was in 2012. You might have heard about Target realizing that a young woman was pregnant before she knew she was pregnant. Problem was she was 14, I think, 15. But the reason that it discovered this is because running big data, and this was, again, at the very beginning of sort of machine learning, but Target had discovered that 25 products correlated to whether or not someone was pregnant. And if you ordered them in certain bunches or at certain times, you could sort of figure out. So what it did, it has since gotten much better apparently, but also they have dumbed down their algorithm. So they would send out like targeted mailing stuff to people. And they sent a targeted mailer to her, addressed to her at her house. And her parents are like, what the hell are you doing, Target? Why are you telling our 14-year-old daughter to look at baby stuff? And then it turns out because she was pregnant. So they got that right. These algorithms have gotten better and better again because they're identifying salient characteristics. Self-driving cars, that's all they're doing, right? When they're training these self-driving cars, they're simply attempting to get the data set big enough, right? And so right now, in all of the self-driving work that goes on, they're driving cars around with humans driving them, trying to build up a large enough data set. Google Translate, Siri, of course, Alexa, these natural language programs, all of those things are machine learning. So in terms of law, what does this mean? Well, we already see this in earnest when it comes to predictive coding. Predictive coding is taking leaps and bounds forward sort of every day. At this point, I think that most legal practices are of any sort of major case are all about discovery that's going to be predictively coded. People aren't reading discovery anymore. So when I started practice, I had a big case for Deloitte & Touche. We wound up having, in that case, about 2.5 million documents that we figured were relevant. There were about 5 million documents in total. That wasn't that long ago. I'm old, but not that old. But it was before any predictive coding. So what did we do? We hired a firm that hired a bunch of temp employees, right, and put them in this gigantic ballroom at a hotel in downtown Minneapolis, hired them for like 4 weeks or whatever, like, you know, hundreds of people who would sit there and read documents. And what we did was we said, you know, here are some words to look for, dates to look for, people to look for. And these temps would just spend all day like highlighting and segregating documents. That is no longer the world, right? That case doesn't happen anymore in the real world. Instead, what we do is predictive coding. And predictive coding works exactly like I was describing the general idea of machine learning. You start with a seed set. So in a case of 5 million documents, seed set's probably in the neighborhood of 1,000, 1,500 documents. Lawyers hand code those, say, here, this document's relevant, this document isn't. And all you're doing with the seed set is you're not really collating the data very carefully. You just randomly pick 1,500 documents from your sample. And then you're saying, this one matters, this one doesn't. Good seed setting these days mostly involves like a estimate on, let's say, a scale of 1 to 5 or 1 to 10. You say, this is really, you know, this is a 10, this is a super great document, this is a 5, this is whatever. Sort of rank them, put them down, and then you feed that into the computer. And the computer then runs and spits out a set of, say, another 1,500 or 2,000 documents, and you go through them and say, yeah, you got it right, no, you didn't get it right, and sort of, again, rank them, if you will. Go through that process, and suddenly you get a predictive formula that gets generated. Again, the great thing about this is it doesn't necessarily hinge on like your code words. This is not just like what we did with hiring temps, where we said look for a date or look for a name. Instead, you just say this document is relevant, and the computer will extract data from that and look for other data, right? And it may be that you found a document that was really relevant because you thought it was between these two people on this date, but there are other things about that document that are similar to other documents that humans just aren't noticing. The algorithm will. You can refine that process a couple of times, and on really important cases, the seed set will be run several times, 2-3 times, but by the end of it, you wind up being able to have your 5 million document set distilled by predictive coding, by narrowing down what your documents are. Now, this does raise some real ethical problems. There are very few ethical decisions that I am aware of about that have been challenged about how that comes out. But of course, the ethical concern is that this is like using an outside consultant to do what is fundamentally, you know, lawyer work, right? I mean, if your client is paying you a bunch of money to represent them and you got 5 million documents, are you comfortable that the algorithm is getting all of your documents? I mean, I am, but I probably am more comfortable with math and with algorithms than some folks are. This is definitely pushing the envelope about what role lawyers can and should allow technology to have. But this is already happening. What other things are currently happening in law and AI? Well, this platform, Juristat, is a patent company. They do work and create data sets that's designed to do sort of three different things. They allow for examiner reports, and in fact, this is new, right? You all have, as law students, if you're law students, access to Lexis, what do they call it? LexisConnect. What's the new Lexis? LexisAdvance. LexisAdvance and the Westlaw Next, not Next, Westlaw.
Edge,
thank you very much. Yes, these are both new approaches to allowing you to get deeper data about judges and those sorts of things. Well, this is like that, only on steroids. This allows you to examine your patent examiner and make very fine-grained distinctions about what your patent examiner is likely to do or not do. It's hugely valuable, obviously, to companies that are applying for a patent. So the examiner feature gets used quite a bit. It also allows for drafters to increase the probability of having their patent assigned to one technology class or the other, which can wind up creating all sorts of advantages. I'm not a patent lawyer myself, but the idea of being able to predict what classification your patent is going to be put into, hugely valuable. Less used, but only sort of very recent. I think this was only in the last year and a half that they did this. They have business analytics, which if you pay them an arm and a leg, allows you to compare your patent processes, how fast you're getting your patents through, to other similar sorts of companies and gain all kinds of insights about your process versus other companies. This is all AI driven. So this is all gets better over time as you get a bigger and better data set. It's kind of like stats, right? Stats, the sort of, when you take stats 101, they always tell you that the more data, the better. This is exactly the same thing. The more people use it, the better it gets. It's like Siri, right? Siri sort of sucked initially. Siri still kind of sucks. Sorry. Oh, Siri, look at that. Hey, no, yeah, I know you're right there. Shut up. So Siri likes me. But Siri is not so great still, but it does get better, right, every month because there are more people doing it and using it. Then something that's near and dear to my heart, this company, Kira, deals with contract analysis through machine learning. This company is really, really interesting. It's been around for a while, and the base service that it offers has gotten pretty good. Companies can basically upload, I mean, it's a harder process than that, but they put their contracts in, and the basic machine learning algorithm extracts for them sort of what the key elements of their contract are. So this is mostly for clients rather than lawyers who've got contracts and don't really know what the hell they say or mean. So they plug this thing in and it extracts out sort of the key terms for them and compares those key terms to other similar contracts. So not only can you learn what your contract's primary key provisions are, but you can see how that compares to other things in the industry or other similar sorts of contracts. But the more cutting edge part of this is, and I'll say this at the end as well, sort of contract drafting. So designing a contract is, of course, we think of a pretty quintessentially lawyer-like experience. Though those of us who have drafted contracts in the real world know a lot of it's sort of templates, right? You just take a template and sort of tweak it or make it a little bespoke here or there. But that might not be the most efficient way to make a contract. I mean, truthfully, like I teach dispute resolution classes like arbitration, and I am always shocked and gobsmacked and just disappointed as all imagination at how bad dispute resolution clauses are drafted. They are so bad. They are so, so abysmally bad. It would be beneficial for parties to actually have more bespoke, thoughtful dispute resolution clauses, but they just don't want to spend the money for them. But what if you could ask parties a series of four or five simple questions and then have a semi-bespoke dispute resolution clause sort of pumped out to you, right? Have the computer sort of design a quasi-bespoke, and then the lawyers can look at it, of course. That's sort of the cutting edge of contract drafting AI. We have some of that already in the marketplace. This company does some, and now there are some competitors that have come out. So it's not just analyzing anymore, it's also thinking about designing and drafting contracts. Some other uses that we see happening in the world, some other places that we go, legal spending analytics. This is a big deal. In fact, I am of counsel at a law firm, and we are working for a couple of large companies, including Cargill and 3M on a regular basis. And both of them have just started to employ some legal spending analytical software. This software allows them to sort of monitor us as lawyers and see how we stack up to other lawyers. Part of what it does is predict how much a case should cost. So that's a helpful thing for in-house counsel. It can also be useful for lawyers and law firms, although it's kind of expensive. But you can wind up plugging in sort of the basic details of case and getting a rough estimate of what that should look like. Then you can hold your law firm accountable when they don't seem to be adding up to what your numbers should be. This is changing dramatically the business practice of law, especially for large firms or for firms dealing with large clients. This is definitely becoming part of the revolution that you've probably heard of and been talking about sort of legal fees and alternative fee arrangements and various ways of paying for legal fees. Well, this is a big change. The other kind of litigation spending analysis AI that's going on has to do with third-party litigation funding. Third-party litigation funding has experienced a gigantic growth in the last few years, especially for international disputes. There are still some ethical concerns domestically, and so it's not entirely clear. There are some rules that prohibit non-lawyers basically taking a bet about a case, and that's kind of what litigation funding winds up being, is kind of a bet about a case. But those rules may be being softened in the United States. They definitely are softened internationally. And so another area of litigation spending analytics going on has to do with predicting outcomes, which is down on my list a little bit as well. You got negotiation analytics. Negotiation analytics are everything from, and this happens more and more, again, with ODR, where you've got basic chatbots that are helping parties sort of reach resolution through negotiation. They're negotiation chatbots. They ask all of the basic, if you've taken a negotiation class, you've got sort of those basic lists of questions that you ask your clients. Well, these do that in sort of what you would think of as the shuttle diplomacy room where you put the clients in separate rooms. Only now it's just a computer asking the questions. But the way the computer, the algorithms are written and the way that machine learning helps increase the predictability and usefulness of the data is that they'll ask you questions about how you what you value, right? And they'll break the dispute into smaller value chunks and then slowly ratchet up one side's willingness to pay on certain components of value or ratcheting down the other side and get you to some number that works, right? And it does this sort of by breaking the dispute into smaller chunks so that basically at the end of the day, you can't argue with the logic when it gets there. Now, of course, it doesn't always work, but those are in practice now, and those are a fairly regular part of some practices. But there are other negotiation analytics that are becoming more useful, like how you value your case. In fact, one that our firm just used was to value a fairly hard to value, or I thought it was a fairly hard to value case, a contract dispute. That had some international components to it. This thing cranked out a number, and the more I look at it, the more I think it might be sort of right about what the likely outcomes are. So it winds up predicting for clients and for lawyers sort of a range of possibilities. Now, again, you might think, well, that's pretty quintessentially what lawyers do. I kind of think about this as this, it's like data-driven medicine, right? Doctors are reluctant to use data-driven medicine because they feel like making a diagnosis is sort of what I do as a doctor, right? Yeah, sort of. I mean, this isn't going to replace ultimately your diagnosis, but the thing that the computer can do that you can't is it can look at so much more information, right? A human doctor can hold in their head at best, you know, 1,000, 2,000 possible diagnoses. There are, for any given disease, 20, 24,000 possible diagnoses. A human doctor only knows what patient they see, right? If you're a doctor here in North Dakota and suddenly there's some, you know, African-born tick disease that shows up on your doorstep, you're not going to think about it because this is just not something you see every day, right? But it's quite possible that there's an African-born tick disease here in North Dakota. The computer can helpfully know, well, there were 8 other people who had these symptoms who popped up at hospitals around North Dakota. Suddenly, this becomes much more likely as the right diagnosis. That's true of this, too. So I think of these sort of negotiation tools that help you value your case as simply being access to more information than I can process as a human. Doesn't mean I don't look at it. I still look at it. I think through it. I decide if it makes sense. But it is an initial tool that can help you. Then you've got litigation prediction. That's kind of what the Lexis Advance and Westlaw, the new West Edge, are aiming towards. But they're still sort of in their infancy, although Westlaw has tools that are much more advanced than what they have currently released to the marketplace. So they have some real advanced litigation analytics for certain domains. So they will release, I think, in the next year, for instance, non-competes. Non-competes are typically what Professor McGinnis was talking about, you know, do what's reasonable. Reasonableness is always sort of hard to nail down, like what is reasonable for parties to do. Well, that's tough in non-competes. There's a lot of that sort of soft, squishy stuff. So what this does is it looks at tens of thousands of cases in a given jurisdiction like California, looks for similar sorts of characteristics, and then cranks out, here's what's reasonable in California for this particular kind of provision. It's really pretty impressive stuff. Those kinds of predictions, again, are, I think, on the horizon. I don't know how accurate they'll ultimately be, but I think that much like SCOTUS prediction, it might be more surprising than you think. Compliance prediction. we already see this with like the IRS. We already know the IRS flags certain things because of numbers that look funky. This is just a uptick in the sophistication of that kind of work. You can start looking for rogue behavior by looking at patterns of behavior that correlate to people doing naughty things that they shouldn't be doing. So we can sort of predict and think about that. And then, as I said, contract drafting, being able to go out there and not just analyze a contract, but draft a contract. So what does all this mean for the future of law and the practice of law? Well, I think it's going to change a lot. I mean, we've already seen it change, and things like electronically stored information, right? And in many ways, what Professor McGinnis and what Tracy were talking about, just the raw impact of storing information electronically has changed the practice of law. So these techniques, which are not just about storing information, but about accessing and utilizing it, portend some really big changes to the work that we all are going to do. But at the end of the day, I don't know that it ultimately, I think it changes the landscape of how we do our work. I don't know that it ultimately changes the work fundamentally that we do as lawyers, at least anytime in the near future. Until Google has a sort of Google Truth-O-Meter, I don't think that we're going to wind up changing the fact that we have to make reasoned arguments on behalf of our clients to achieve certain outcomes. This has just given us some different and potentially better tools to do it. It does change, however, I think, the world for sort of what it is that initial young attorneys do, what it is that paralegals do. That's going to change. The days of sitting in young lawyers, I mean, it used to be when I came out and practice, sat in a room for, you know, your first year going through boxes of discovery. That's what you did with your life, which sucked. I don't think that's going to be true anymore. So young professionals are coming into the world at a different place, and that imposes some different obligations on them as well. I mean, it's more fun, probably, but it also means that you have to be providing value in a different way faster. So I tell my students, this is a way for you to provide value to your clients right out of the get-go, because I guarantee you that older attorneys in your firm don't understand what's going on with predictive coding. They might use it, but they are not really understanding what's going on. You coming out, being thoughtful about this sort of thing, can really provide value to your clients, to your firms, to your partners, by helping them think through the issues that are there. With that, I'm done like 15 minutes early, mostly because I feel like this is a really long time to talk without saying anything. So if you've got questions for me, I'm happy to answer them. But you know, I'm also happy to let you get coffee or whatever you got to do. So, yeah.
Is there a specific state or place where that's using a lot of this AI technology where you can kind of look to see the consequences of it in the future, like kind of so that us in smaller states can predict what may happen here?
Yeah. I mean, so it depends on the domain, right? So the online dispute resolution for sure. So you could look at New York. The New York test pilot project has already started, but it'll roll out officially. So it's in its beta test right now, but it'll roll out officially this fall, I think, when it comes out. You can also look at the UK, actually. The United Kingdom has got an online dispute resolution process that is supposed to roll out this year, though they've had some funding problems and, I don't know, some complications. So those are jurisdictions for sort of online dispute resolution. In terms of like predictive coding, that's everywhere, but it may be that you wind up seeing that primarily at larger firms. But what I would suggest is go, like what you can do to sort of learn more about it is you can go to any of the big document production companies, right? So you can go to Loeffler, Icon, all of those places do predictive coding. You can learn from those websites, but you can also probably, and that's something that the law school could think about doing as well, is bring them in. I'm quite sure they'd be happy to come in and chat with you about predictive coding technologies and where they're at with that. For the other sorts of technologies, there's not really a jurisdiction, so far as I'm aware, that's doing more or less. It's mostly these companies. And again, at this point, because it's so expensive, it's a lot of big businesses. But like all technology, that trickles down. I mean, we currently, at the firm that I'm at, we're dealing with a local Minnesota company that's smaller than, I mean, it's it's a $15 million a year business. I mean, it's not a small, small business, but it's certainly not a big business, right? That's not a big state, big sort of national, but they're doing some of this analytical work with Jurist for their patents. So I think this is technology that will trickle down eventually, but it's a good question. I mean, getting access to it is tricky. And a lot of this, like all sort of innovation, is stuff that's easier to learn about while you're in school. So my other piece of advice is don't be as shy about like contacting these companies and sort of asking questions. As a student, they're going to be more willing to talk with you. Once you're out there in the real world, they want to charge you money because they want to make money. So it's harder to learn about these things once you're in the real world. Yeah.
So I'm thinking about this in terms of the government, and actually to get a hold of this AI technology, and lawyers can use this, the prosecutors use this, and so they're looking at predictive indicators for offenders or might be offenders, right? Thinking about that. So are there groups other than governmental organizations like the ABA that are looking at and based on compliance, but others that are looking at whether or studying the ethical
Yeah, there's been a lot of discussion of it. So in probation hearings, there's been some states that have piloted programs to look at probation risk, and that has gotten a lot of pushback ethically, right? That's not what a probation hearing should be about. But in some ways, of course, that is what a probation hearing is about. Like, there's a lot of back and forth, and some of it winds up being inflected with these sorts of biases about what the technology does. I find most of the debates problematic because they don't really understand what the technology is doing and what the limits are, which is another reason I think it's really important for lawyers to get a grip on what the technology is doing, right? Again, not necessarily at the fine-grained mathematical level, but you got to see what it's doing in order to have those debates, because I think they're really important, right? So I do not know of any programs that are overtly trying to, let's say, determine guilt or innocence of a criminal case based on this, but you could imagine that sort of process happening, absolutely, right? You could imagine those being conversations that are had, and much like self-driving cars, there's some really big philosophical questions, right? I mean, we might be able to make a self-driving car, but self-driving cars, for instance, could probably determine, well, would be able to determine much faster how many passengers are in a car. Let's imagine that there's a physical error with the car and it's going to crash, right? The car could either crash in a way that kills the occupants of one car or the occupants of the other. That decision is a ethical, philosophical decision. Is it simply about the number of people in the car? Is it about how much money the people in the car make? Is it about whether there's a kid in the car and their ages? Like, what basis does the decision get made? That's not a decision that AI can solve, right? And I think that's the same fundamental question you're asking about, you know, guilt or innocence is not simply about probabilities or the weight of the evidence. In that sense, there is a human kind of decision-making process that requires us to think about what it is we want this technology to do. But with the probation, yes, there have been some pilot programs and some pushback. There's also been, I think, with sex offenders, there was a program, I want to say in Michigan, but I don't know, that was talking about this with sex offenders and potential recidivism rates. There was one other thing I was going to say about that. It just escaped me. I'll see if I can remember. But yes, I think you're right. Government using this for non-civil purposes, which is not my area, but I think presents some real quandaries and problems for sure. Yeah.
A couple days ago, I read a newspaper, like Norway or somewhere in Europe, there was other countries where they were going to start starting with decisions like small claims be decided by essentially algorithms, AI, on like how small things decisions. So if you have something like that with, then you look at plaintiff's defense or government also using AI to also come to their strategic plan, also then also be decided by another program, AI. I mean, should you already know what the outcome is then? I mean, if you already can kind of plan out
Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting question. And in some ways, it does implicate some concerning questions about automation in general, right? So something I didn't talk about that I probably should have is blockchain technology. Tracy made mention of the Internet of Things, right? Blockchain technology, which is sort of the technology used in Bitcoin, but basically all it is a distributed ledger, kind of can take away that the current legal value of it is that we could do away with contracts. When I teach contracts, I think about playground logic a lot, right? You don't need contract if you and I can trade my whatever it is, I don't have anything. I trade my phone for money, right? And I can hand you the phone and you hand me the money. We don't need contract because I can protect myself playground style. You don't give me the money, I take my phone back, right? But contract protects prospective things. Blockchain allows that prospective thing to still have playground logic. It sort of automates. But going to your question, there was a company not too long ago that wound up automating all of its decision making. It had no executives, no CEO, no board, no nothing. All it had was shareholders. Shareholders could make some basic decisions, invest money, and then algorithms would actually implement the decisions. Bad thing happened. There was some people called it a problem in the code. Some people called it just the code, and the code was the contract, but it allowed a hacker or someone who was able to understand the code to expropriate $50 million of the $160 million that had been given by investors. Again, there was some debate about whether that was actually a hack or not, because it was the code, and if the code is the contract, then it was just complying with the contract and taking advantage of a loophole. But that was a big problem. And I think what your question implicates is, you know, if we remove humans so far, right, and humans no longer can see the intricate moving parts, what does that mean? What does that mean for the world, right? I think we're already there in so many ways. Like, I can't explain to you how my iPhone does what my iPhone does. I can't explain how email really works. I mean, I have a super rudimentary understanding, but that means that there's effectively a kind of magic to it. And I do worry about that with law. We wind up extracting far enough back, the internal workings become obfuscated. Yeah.
I just got all up on that.
Yeah.
Like, for instance, like Drewstat and Okara, like, they didn't have like internal integrity monitoring that you just send out a message when issues like that.
Yeah, they're supposed to, but how well they work is, you know, sort of up in the air. Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, this is true. You know, Tracy was talking about even like Dropbox. I mean, Dropbox does as well. It's not as secure as other sorts of cloud-based things, but all of these, all security measures are becoming machine learning measures. So in theory, they're supposed to be getting better and better, like your spam filter does or like Spotify's algorithm does. But again, without understanding the intricacies of how it works, whether or not that's actually effective is a question, right? It's easy to understand how to secure your office because you lock the door. It's much harder to understand how to secure your data when you don't really understand what the technology is that's doing the securing. It's all great questions. Yeah.
Sort of the comment on, you know, what's this team kind of with Minority Report, one piece that might focus people's attention is on China, what they're doing with a lot of AI and their technology. One, they have the data to actually power AI system, but then with their government structure too, they have the ability to do that. And they have like a social credit system now where all their information is kind of included on the web. It's based on kind of artificial, not artificial intelligence, but the data that they do in life as well.
Yeah.
As far as going to school and
We're not, but this is another area that I don't, I mean, it's not about AI directly, but it is about the sort of seed of AI, which is data, right? So another area that law has got to wrestle with, and United States law in particular, is data protection and data law, right? So it's not just data protection in the sense of protecting sensitive data, it's data protection in the sense of whether or not you have a property entitlement to your private information. So right now, for instance, Facebook gets a lot of work for you for free. Right. They don't charge you. Facebook doesn't charge you. And so you think, oh, you're getting this great deal. Facebook's actually going to make a crap ton of money off of your labor. You go onto Facebook right now. In fact, I know that I'm not a Facebook user myself, but you know, you can, it's my understanding when you post a picture, you can put little tags on the picture that say things like what's going on in the picture. That's all for machine learning. That's not to help you or to make Facebook better for you. That's to make an algorithm so they can figure out what's going on in pictures so they can do other things and monetize it. That's a kind of labor, right? And what the value or right of your labor sort of property right is an area of law that's important, but protecting your private data and what goes on with private data is an area that is not about AI directly, but about what's necessary to make AI work. That's an area law has got to wrestle with for sure. And I think China is doing that. China is doing it as a matter of governmental social policy, right? Or some elements of that. So you're absolutely right. They are. Yeah, they are. Yeah. All right. Well, thank you all very much. It was a pleasure coming here and talking with you.